Welcome back to The Injury Pros, where we dig into real stories behind personal injury law. I'm Mike Sale from Cordisco & Sale, and today's episode, we talk about what it really takes to become a successful injury lawyer. I'm joined with Chris Najat, a seasoned attorney and partner at Gropper Najat, who focuses in the practice of personal injury law. Chris is licensed in New York and New Jersey, and today we're going to explore why he chose personal injury and how attorneys can shape a resilient long-term career in the field. Let's jump in. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you, Mike.
It's been a long time coming.
I know. Great to be here.
I was just thinking back how many years we've known each other now.
I mean, it's
over 20 years, I think, right?
It's got to be. We first met in memories in Margate.
And then probably on the beach the next day.
Yeah, of course.
Hanging out, having a good time. Enjoying the sun. I think we met through some mutual friend.
Yes.
And then at that point, were you still in law school or did you graduate?
I was in law school.
I'm thinking about like maybe 2004-ish, maybe.
I think right around there.
It was the summer we had a place down there. We were all down there all summer.
It had to have been 2004, 2003 maybe. So over 20 years.
Yeah, so I graduated in 2002. So I was 2 years out of law school when we met.
No, you know what? I was not in law school yet.
No?
No, because when we went to Vegas for our friend's bachelor party, I was a first-year law student.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, I didn't inspire you to go to law school.
That's for sure. And at his wedding, I was a second-year law. I remember that because I was studying for finals right before his wedding.
So you know, tell us about your family and where you came from and why you went to law school.
So it's actually a funny story. They say I'm Persian, right? And they say that, you know, there's four career choices in a Persian family, and it's doctor, lawyer, engineer, or disgrace the family. So from a young age, my dad always, he always wanted me to be a lawyer. He always said, you know, you can be a lawyer. And then when I would tell people that too, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, when I was a kid, I'd say, you know, most kids wanted to be a football player, basketball player, which I think I also wanted to for a little, but I'd say I want to be a lawyer. And then, you know, you lose track of things when you're in school, when you're in college, and then towards, you know, probably my junior year in college, kind of have to decide what you want to do. And at that point, I was like, wow, I can really become a lawyer. Like, I can do this. My grades are good enough. I got a tutor for the LSAT. Took the LSAT and, you know, applied to schools.
So you knew for a long time you wanted to be a lawyer?
Yeah, I knew since I was a kid I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't know why, you know, but I do now. I know why I do it now. I know what my why is.
Well, let's jump into that. What's your why?
Well, my why is, you know, and I learned from my law partner, Josh, he's one of the most respected trial attorneys in New York City. And, you know, he's my mentor as well. And, it's about the clients. That's the most important thing, right? It's all about helping people and the clients. His brother Danny was involved. You met Danny.
Yep, Danny.
In a house fire when he was in college. He's a quadruple plegic with burns on 90% of his body. He's one of the most inspirational. Am I right?
He's got the best attitude. We hung out with him, this spring
in Atlantic
City at the trial lawyers conference. And he was like the funnest guy to hang out with.
Yeah. So he was Josh's reason to go into law. Because if it wasn't for a amazing attorney that helped him back then, you know, his brother wouldn't be able to live the comfortable life he lives now, you know, obviously relatively speaking. So that, I guess, that mission statement or that corporate culture, that's what I was taught directly from him, right? It's money secondary, all that stuff secondary. It's about, you know, you can change people's lives.
And you found your why in personal injury law, right?
I did.
Representing people, right?
I did.
Not the corporation. So, did you have any lawyers in your family, though?
I did not have any. I'm the first lawyer in my family.
That's pretty good. Congratulations.
Yeah. We've had a lot of doctors.
All right. Well, it's good to mix it up, right?
Yeah.
And chances are you might be doing better than some of these doctors.
But, I don't know. With the private equity now that makes our life miserable.
Yeah, but they have it, too. They have it, too. So that's great. So where'd you go to law school?
I went to Rutgers.
Rutgers in New Jersey. Right?
Yes. That's actually, I went to undergrad there where I met my wife, Candace, my senior year in entrepreneurship class.
Oh.
We now have three lovely kids, Amy, who is 7, Nate, who's 4, and Luna, who's 5 months. And she always says that, you know, it all goes back to that first look, you know, because we made eye contact in the classroom on the first day of class.
Sweet. She's an entrepreneur too, right?
Yes. She owns a wedding favor business, eulily.com. Go there, get all your bachelorette party hats, your bags. Come on.
So what's it like balancing, you know, life with 3 kids, now 1, a very young child, and a busy law practice?
Well, I'll give you an example. It is me. I love having kids. Probably my purpose in life, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't think that. I was always the guy who was like, I'm never having kids, you know? But you forget how hard a newborn is. Really hard.
Imagine.
My wife does a lot more work than I do. You know, she's an amazing mother. But you know, it's a lot of work. Like, it's constant attention. My boys, thankfully, they're really helpful. They're really good, and I guess they're not complaining because they're getting, you know, more iPad times. Usually, yeah. You know, we'd be more tough on, but it's tough. It's tough balancing the family life, because, you know, I say the law takes precedent, because I'm more worried about other people's lives and cases and things like that. Like, it's the highest compliment to be trusted with people's friends, family, colleagues, and, you know, you don't want to let anybody down.
Yeah, I always say you get one chance to represent. You got to do your best and give it your all. But family's important too, and it's a tough balance, because now you have boys and they're going to be in sports, right? And I have 3 boys and they're in sports every single night. So having your own practice, I think, gives you the flexibility to be able to come and go. But, you know, people see me coming in a little bit later, but staying a little bit later. But they also know that I work weekends and nights and all that kind of stuff. So that there's no real work-life balance, I think. What I've heard, it's just you got to do what you got to do every day and do the best you can. How do you manage that?
Well, people talk about days off. I don't have days off. My clients all have my cell phone number. You know, they need something, they call me. You can cut that out if clients don't have Mike's cell phone number. You probably should. You know what I mean? To kind of like throw a little bit of shade. But I'll re-record that. You know, there are no days off.
That's staying in.
There are no days off. You know, I'm always on my email. If a new case comes in, if it's a, you know, cases on like a Saturday, I've left family vacays down Jersey Shore, driven 2 hours to Harlem Hospital to sign a client up, because, you know, these people need you. And that's important. And you know, yes, you get to come and go as you please for the most part, but, you know, on the other side of it, you're really never off.
You're still putting in more time than everybody else.
Absolutely.
More effort. And it all ends with you, whether you succeed, your clients succeed.
Absolutely. You know, the one thing I joked with Cropper about, my law partner, is that you forget about the administrative side of things, right? Now that I'm doing, you know, a lot more administrative stuff since 2020, like payroll and, you know, and just paying bills, paying medicals, you know, balancing the escrow account,
right,
auditing it. Yeah. It's like you feel like you don't have as much time to just be a lawyer, and you really miss those days where you could like just be a lawyer, right? Like, I have some really good people that write my, you know, that write my briefs, and they, you know, the top people that you can have. But I do miss the days where, you know, I'd be working till 11, 12 o'clock at night looking up case law, you know?
It all depends what you really love to do, right? You can love administrative work. You can love marketing. You love being a trial lawyer. Or you can love doing the busy work. I don't love doing the busy work anymore.
I don't, but I like to do it from time to time.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, I like to say, I heard this quote, and it was really interesting. It's nice to do like the grunt work sometime, because it reminds you of who you'd be if you weren't who you are.
Exactly.
Right?
And like, it's good to start there and then build up. I'm sure you'll be successful with Josh Cropper and moving in the future, but even I can honestly say to every employee here, I've done everything. I've answered the phone. I've cleaned the office. I've requested medical records. I've written demand letters. I do trial. I was the bookkeeper, you know. I've done everything. So to master being a leader and eventually delegating that with employees or people that are helping you do these more minuscule tasks so that you can be, you know, the best at being a leader or what you're really good at. It's you have to know everything and how the systems work. I've seen so many older lawyers go through, oh, I don't even know how to use a fax machine back in the day. Yeah. Like the lawyers don't know how to operate anything, so that they become held hostage to some of their employees because the lawyer doesn't know how to do anything. So it's important to know everything so that you can hire the right people that are actually better at you than doing the busy work than you are, so you can focus your brain on leading and growing the firm.
Yeah, I like to say that there's nothing that I wouldn't ask somebody to do that I wouldn't do myself, right? And I used to, you know, for some reason, our New York office years ago, a big deal would be the trash. So certain people just didn't want to take the trash out. So I was like, you know what? Just down the hall. I'm like, I'll take the trash, right? Just so people can see, like, hey, you know, I'm part of the team. And yes, at that point, I think I was an associate. I wasn't a partner yet. My name wasn't on the door yet either. But still, you know, you're in a leadership position.
Yeah. I still clean the kitchen. I still pick up trash on the floor. That's just part of us. Try to be, you know, the best we can every day and move along. But tell me about, so you graduated law school from Rutgers, right? What year?
I graduated in 2009.
Okay. And then where did you end up after law school?
So I did a summer associate position at a large defense firm, right?
Unnamed large defense.
Yeah, yeah.
That's okay.
You can look at my LinkedIn.
Who were you defending? What kind of case?
I was defending trucking cases, medical malpractice cases, coverage cases, insurance coverage, things like that.
So basic defense work.
Yeah, basic defense.
Was that in New Jersey?
It was out of New Jersey. They had a New York office, they had a Philadelphia office. There's a lot of offices.
Well, you got barred in New Jersey and New York, right?
Correct. I got offered positions in the New York and the New Jersey office. I did take the Jersey office because I was, I had done my summer associate there. I thought there'd be more.
Well, that's where you lived.
Yeah, I lived there at the time, correct.
Your wife and your kids there now, at least.
Yes.
That's where you're based out of, right?
Correct.
And then how long did you work at this firm?
A couple of years.
A couple of years. Got some good experience.
I did, not really. Like, it was just, so when I always say that young lawyers should start off in like car accidents, right? If you're going to be in this business, because then you learn how to take depositions, things like that. I started off at like a really complex area of law, like medical malpractice. So,
wow.
So I'd be going through, you know, depositions and doing page and lines, right? Where you find things and you put them in. It was just a lot of
tedious work.
It's a lot of work. Like, they, you know,
a lot of reading.
And it's now AI would do stuff like that, right? Yep. But it wasn't a good situation for me.
But you learn like the parts of litigation, I'm sure, like the defense side.
Yeah.
They don't have real pre-litigation departments like we do side. You start with answering the complaint, right? So you learned the basic steps of litigation and
sort of there, a little bit. I did answer a couple complaints, but it wasn't a good place for me. In fact, I wanted to leave law.
Okay.
Just because I was like, well, this is, you know,
we hear that from the defense side.
Yeah,
a lot of employees on the defense side want to work with us. That's neither here nor there. But so you lasted almost 2 years or 2 years or what?
Something like that. Yeah,
like that. And then what happened? Tell us what happened next.
So I was looking, you know, I was looking for jobs and I was applying everywhere. Just, you know, I had my MBA as well. So I wasn't really sure what area I wanted to go into. And because of the, because being in litigation, I didn't think I wanted to be in litigation. But then I was actually involved in my own accident.
Okay.
And I kind of got to see the inside out of the plaintiff side.
Tell us about your accident.
It was a rear end. It was a rear end car accident. And, you know, I managed my own case. I did have an attorney, but I was injured. I went right to the hospital. I got a lot of treatment, and, you know, ultimately settled the case. But I learned it, and I wanted to do plaintiff's work.
So from that experience, you went from not wanting to do litigation, maybe not like an injury, back in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was like, this is something I can do, and. To be fair to the firm, former firm I worked at, I don't necessarily think I had the skill set to be a good defense attorney, because you almost have to be efficiently inefficient.
Tell us about that.
Like, you had the bill for everything you do.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So
it's never fun. I've done that in the past.
And you're incentivized to drag cases out longer and to bill more. But
almost unethical when you think about it.
Well, I'm not saying they do that. No. But generally speaking, that's the concept behind it, right? Because you have to look out, you know, for your clients. So, and that's why clients, your cases are dragged out. I can tell you, it's not us. We want our money too, right?
You want to move them fast.
Yeah, yeah.
So from there, I applied to some jobs in the plaintiff's firm, and you know, one of the, you know, I did apply through Craigslist. I applied through Craigslist.
Is that still around?
I don't know, but back then that's where you'd like find a job. So don't judge me.
So we're talking like what, 2011-ish or
probably, yeah, or probably. So 2012, I believe. Yeah. Okay. So I met Josh. And I
went to Josh through Craigslist?
Through Craigslist. Oh, man. Right?
I thought it was a dating site. Craigslist, wow.
So we met through Craigslist and we had a really good interview. And then at the end of the interview, there's a 7-Eleven at the bottom. We're having a great time talking and stuff. And one of my things always is like, leave on a high note. So I don't want to drag things on, because there's a better possibility that I'll say something to mess it up. If I'm like, you know.
You're too loose.
Right. So he's like, all right, I'm going downstairs to get a Slurpee. You want one? Like, what?
Did you buy him a Slurpee?
No, he went in and got a Slurpee. That's like,
that's my favorite thing at 7-Eleven.
Yeah, that's his too. He's like getting a Slurpee. And he's like a fitness guy too. You know what I mean? Like kind of like yourself, you know, works out every day. And I'm like, and then he still jokes around about this. I'm like, no, I'm all right, pal. He called me pal.
So did you interview in New Jersey, I guess?
New York. New
York.
Yeah. I interviewed in our current office, was on Madison Ave.
Okay.
I interviewed there. And, you know, I went back for a second interview.
And Josh is from New York, right?
Yes. Yeah. He's from Long Island originally.
On the rack.
He bounced around to Massachusetts as a kid and California.
He's been practicing for a long time.
Yeah, he's been practicing since late 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
mid to late 80s.
So he offered you a job?
He did offer me the job with, yeah.
And then did you work in New York for a while, or did you open up the New Jersey office right away?
No, I worked in New York for about probably 7 years. 7 years I worked in New York.
So you got to know all the New York nuances of personal injury law?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I still practice in New York. I essentially... is New York, right? And then Josh was embarred in New Jersey, so I started bringing in little by little Jersey cases.
Okay.
And then our Jersey practice grew, so I opened up a Jersey office.
Where's your Jersey office?
So it's in Cherry Hill. So it's a funny story, though.
Okay.
So in 2017, I became a partner, and then 2020, I got my name on the door, and then we're like, let's open up the Jersey office in 2020, because we have so many cases. So March 1st, 2020, our lease went into effect for the Jersey off.
Oh, wow.
20 days later, the pandemic hit. Or 15 days later.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
So did you go to the office at all in the beginning or no?
No. So where our office is, they worked with us and they back-ended the lease. Like they took, you know, a couple months off the front, put it on the back. But at the end of the day, we're still there. So, you know, 5 years later.
Yeah, I remember that time because I signed a contract for 4 billboards. It would be our first billboards ever, 95, like a week before that. And they called the company and pulled it right back, and they were cool with it because, like, we knew nobody was going to be traveling and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
We stayed out of billboards so far since, but someday.
Is that something you want to get into?
Eventually. We're slowly be rebranding. I think I mentioned this to you earlier. You know, the problem with billboards that I see as being a marketer at heart is they all say the same thing, every message. It's like the Yellow Pages back in the 80s or so. Just buy a bigger ad. That's the only way you get attention. Buy more billboards. You have to have a unique message that stands out, that people remember. So that's what we're working on.
I will say, speaking of your practice, I got to say that you've always been, I want to thank you for this, you've always been a mentor to me, and it was really cool watching you grow and grow your firm, and you've always been an inspiration, and how you grew it the right way, treat clients right, and how you market the right way. And every time I call you for advice, not every time, but generally speaking, you always steer me the right way, and more importantly, you always steer me the most ethical way. You know, and that's usually like one of your first questions is, all right, or the way your mind analyzes it when you think out loud. You say like, all right, let's first make sure this is, you know, whatever it is ethical, or you know,
the right thing to do.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate it. I think you said your partner was on the disciplinary board or something like that, right?
John was actually on the real board, right under the Supreme Court, nominated by a Supreme Court justice.
Wow.
There, and he actually was the vice chairman at one point. They served for about 4 years, eventually trickle out. I was a hearing committee member, which is like a three-panel judge, kind of arbitrator. When the ODC, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, gets a complaint from a lawyer that they thought they did something bad, you know, that office looks at them. There's a lot of unfounded claims, but when they think they have a claim, it's almost like a prosecution. So the ODCs are the prosecutors, and basically I was part of a three-judge panel that heard the trial, initial trial. Made findings and recommendations that went up to the disciplinary. So I don't know. I mean, we're in this for the long run. You know, we're still relatively young in this business. We have hopefully a good 15, 20 years ahead of us in the business if we want to. And you got to do things the right way. You got to treat people right. No shortcuts in this business. So try to do the best ethically and the right thing and the golden rule, whatever you want to call it, because what goes around comes around. Your reputation is the only thing you have in this business.
No, absolutely. In any business, your reputation. And the fact that, like, because Gropper, that's another thing. He was always very ethical that I have, you know, not that you're much older than me, but you're a more experienced attorney. You have a couple of years on me as an attorney. And the fact that I can turn to you and Josh and, you know, get the right answers, right? Because as a young attorney, when I was a young attorney, because I see a lot of people I went to law school with who fell, not a lot, but you see people, you hear stories about people here and there who got disbarred or, you know, or got suspended. And a lot of it has to do with who did they, you know, who was their mentor? Who did they fall underneath that, you know, they saw?
Like the average of what? The five people you hang around with most. In the law, we spend a lot of time in the office, so it's who you hang around with. But it's always good to have somebody to work with, too. I mean, we just took on Todd Saylor, doing this actually 2 years longer than I as an attorney. He was by himself for the last 5 years. But one of the reasons he came to us is because he likes the camaraderie. We bounce ideas off each other. We have regular case meetings. Five lawyers get together and discuss an issue. Like, you don't have that when you're by yourself. So that's important. But tell us a little bit more about what Gropper and Najah do. Like, what kind of cases does your firm handle? And what could clients expect if they call your office?
So we're a personal injury firm. We specialize in car accidents, construction accidents, slip and falls, ceiling collapses, you know, that type of case, right? I think in 2017, was it? We had the highest motorcycle verdict in New York City.
Oh, wow.
We've had several seven-figure construction law cases, which is one of our specialties. In New York, you call it the labor law, and there's very favorable protections for construction workers in New York, where the owner, the tenant, and the construction company and the subs. So New York construction law is called the labor law, right? And there's a statute that holds the owner, the tenant, and the construction companies strictly liable. So, I mean, that's huge.
Strictly liable.
Yes, strict liability, for especially with height-related falls, things like that.
Correct.
It really has to do with whether or not they follow the standard, right?
Is that in addition to like workers' comp?
Yes, in addition to workers' comp, correct. And there's usually a monster workers' comp lien that's got to be factored in. But, you know, I mean, a lot of these construction accidents, like, you know, these guys that we've represented, and they've only been men, I'm not being sexist, they can't work again. Right, these are terrible accidents,
yeah.
and you know, they can't provide for their family.
So just so that our viewers and listeners know, because they're not all lawyers listening to this, or some clients or prospective clients, in Pennsylvania, workers' comp includes lost wages and medical benefits to get your medical treatment. Is that the same in New York?
Yes, it's the same in New York. And then it would all be a lien. It would all have to be paid back at the end. So what we do is we negotiate a higher settlement amount because we look at the client's walk-away money.
Gotcha. And then they could have, could you also sue your employer under the strict liability law, or is that a bar?
No, that's a bar because, you know, you're obviously workers' comp. What about Pennsylvania?
It is a bar, too, unless there's, like, recklessness or gross negligence. There's rare exceptions that can get you over the workers' comp bar is what we say. That just means you can't sue your employer,
yeah,
right? But if there's other people involved, other contractors, the business, or the, you said the landowner or the big building owner, things like that, if there is an injury such as a fall, there's almost like a strict liability, meaning that they're at fault no matter what.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that how that works?
Yep.
Right. And then you also said you do like regular car accidents, truck accidents, bus accidents, we hear, you know, all those kind of things, right?
Yeah, we have a ceiling flaps right now with a client. There was notice, which means the defect was complained about, and she's had two total knee replacements as a result.
Gotcha.
You know, we're fighting it out. So
gotcha.
You know, there's a big policy on it, and they're claiming that there's no excess policy. So, you know, what I like to say when they say that is, it's okay, I'll take the building.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So are you, tell us more about your firm. Is it mostly New York based and some Jersey, or is it about 50-50 now?
I would say, so the New York practice, because Josh started the practice in the 90s, Eve. So we do have more New York cases, and the Jersey firm is growing, but I would say about probably like 30% of the cases are Jersey, 70% of the cases are New York.
Okay. That sounds reasonable. But okay, so I don't practice in New York. I do practice in New Jersey, but you know, at Cortisco and Sale, we mostly focus on Pennsylvania. So I obviously know the New Jersey laws involving car accidents, stuff like that. Tell us, is there any main differences between New York law for car accidents and in New Jersey law? Is there anything you want to talk about there?
Yeah, there actually is. So in New York, there isn't, you know how in New Jersey, there's like those certain exceptions to the serious injury threshold?
Okay. Let's break it down because a lot of people don't understand any of this yet. But for example, in Pennsylvania, we have something called limited tort. That means it's a cheaper type of insurance policy where you have to have a serious injury. Court defines it as a significant limitation of a bodily function, which is just legal words for a judge to decide whether it's serious enough to be able to sue. So there's limited tort in Pennsylvania, which is a cheaper policy where you have to have a serious type of injury. And then there's no limited tort or just nothing, which is a full policy, which you could sue for anything. New Jersey has something they call similar called the verbal threshold, right?
Correct.
And that's kind of similar. You have to have a serious injury to be able to recover. And that's a cheaper policy. But the problem is that I found in New Jersey, where I used to practice more in New Jersey, is that 90-something percent of New Jersey drivers have what they call the verbal threshold, which is like New Jersey's form of limited tort. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that what you've seen?
I've seen I'd say yes.
There's some exceptions, like if a commercial vehicle hits you, things like that in New Jersey. We actually don't have that in Pennsylvania, which is weird.
Yeah, so New York, yeah, that's the thing. New York doesn't have that. And in New York, you can't get you can't get full tort. It's only, it's at all limited. It's all limited tort. The only exception, like you said, the, you know, commercial vehicle or something like that, would be if the company doesn't write, the insurance company that for the car doesn't write in the state.
New York,
right,
too?
In New York. So okay. If it's some law.
Oh, okay.
You know, if it's
that's like New Jersey then, too.
Yeah.
They call that the Deamer statute, Jersey.
Correct.
It's very confusing. We don't have to get that into it today. But you're saying that anyone in a New York car accident, most people, they have to have a serious injury to be able to recover anything.
Yes.
Even you can't even buy out of that restriction.
You cannot buy out of that restriction in New York.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
It's
I've heard other states have that, and it just seems like unconstitutional. Like you should have a right to be compensated if somebody does you wrong.
Yeah.
But I guess that's state law and it's been tested, right?
Yeah. And just thinking out loud, and I'm thinking this for the first time, so I don't know if it's true, but it could have something to do with all the cabs in New York City, because yeah, then every time a cab, we get a lot of cabs.
There's a lot of lobbying.
There's a lot. And so every time a cab gets into a car accident, which is very often,
yeah,
it would be a full threshold case, right? You wouldn't have to meet the serious injury threshold.
What about Uber laws and things like that? Because I'm assuming that the cabs have now given into a lot of Uber drivers and Lyft drivers in New York City. Like there's a mix now.
Yeah, there is, but it depends where the Uber comes from.
Okay.
I think there's going to be a change in the law. That's what they're talking about. But, you know, most of these Ubers are insured by an insurance company that's probably the worst insurance company that I've dealt with.
Okay.
And they insure all the cabs. And I'm talking about in New York City. Okay. In New York City, not, you know, not in New Jersey, not in other places. But, you know, they make it very difficult. And they have a $100,000 policy. Usually that's, you know, you're just stuck with that. And unfortunately,
I remember earlier in my career, I don't know if it changed since, because I haven't had many taxi cab accidents in Philadelphia or anything, because there's a lot of Ubers now. But they had minimal insurance, these taxi companies. So they would just settle for whatever. $15,000 is the minimum in Pennsylvania. But now with Uber, it's interesting. Uber, if the Uber driver's at fault, Uber carries a lot of insurance by state law, right? But if you're in an Uber and you have no insurance of your own, you don't drive, nobody in your household has insurance, you're in an Uber and somebody else hits you, if that person's uninsured, you get $0. Uber does not carry underinsured coverage in Pennsylvania.
Really?
Yeah. And they don't have to by law. So they don't. So if you're in an Uber and you don't have any underinsured coverage on your own policy, you ain't going to get a dollar. And they say more than half the people in Philadelphia are uninsured drivers.
Well, yeah, I've had
some, which we see that in our practice.
I've had Ubers in Jersey where it was that similar scenario, and they have $1.5 million in underinsured coverage for Ubers.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So just for our listeners and viewers, underinsured is a, you know, the other party, that's called liability insurance. If you're hit by somebody else, you go after their liability insurance, and their state minimums in Pennsylvania is $15,000. So if your injuries are worth $100,000 and the other driver only has $15,000, you can go back to your policy for what's called underinsured coverage. You have to purchase that coverage to get it, though. You can reject it in Pennsylvania, and I think in New Jersey too, right?
You can have a liability policy.
Yeah, so you can reject underinsured. It's highly recommended to our listeners that you buy as much underinsured as you can afford. There's no set limit. You'd buy as much as they'll offer you as our recommendation. But
well, it's got to match your BI limit. Right. So your bodily injury, yes, which is what people can sue you for. Right. So if you have $100,000 there, you should always look at your policy, and you should always make sure the in New York is called SUM, supplementary uninsured, underinsured coverage. In New Jersey, it's UM, uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage. Look at your policies and make sure they match, because that doesn't automatically happen. And a lot of people have wonderful coverage and they come to me for their bodily injury, but they have almost no coverage for their,
underinsured and uninsured.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can't generally buy more uninsured and underinsured than your liability coverage.
Correct.
So for example, if you have multiple cars, the max you can buy generally in Pennsylvania is $250,000 of coverage for a single car. On liability, $250,000 for one person, $500 max on liability. But if for underinsured, if you had four cars, you can times that line. We have stacking in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know.
Which is I like Pennsylvania a lot better now, which is why we
yeah.
Pennsylvania. If you choose stacking on your policy, you have four cars, you just made that $1 million, 250 times four, an underinsured coverage. And so that's very helpful in Pennsylvania. And we don't have an offset for underinsured against the liability in Pennsylvania. Whatever you purchase on underinsured, you get. In New Jersey, you have to offset it against the liability. The person who caused the crash is insurance. So if you buy, say, $100,000 of underinsured and the other person has $100,000 in liability, you get no underinsured, right?
That is correct. In New York as well.
In Pennsylvania, you get the whole 100 if you're entitled to it.
Yeah. That's...
which is a lot better.
And you know, people don't realize how much, if somebody really does have $1 million worth of injuries, how much that money can help them and how much that money can really, you know, assist them for whatever terrible injury it is.
Thankfully, we have at Cordisco and Sale, we have clients that are severely injured, and we see that a lot. But oftentimes there's $25,000, $15,000, even $100,000. I have had so many death cases where the max I could recover is $100,000. That's all the coverage available. I've had it $15,000. I've had serious motorcycle crashes where people's legs are maimed and they're in the hospital for 6 months, and the max we can get is $15,000. But we have to share that with the health insurance company. And the lawyer needs to get paid something to cover his costs, right? At the very least. So, you know, buy as much insurance as you can afford. In my earlier career, I was always wondering, people ask me how much insurance to buy. Like, we have numbers in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, you know, the max goes up to like 250, 500 and things like that. But I came to the conclusion is buy as much as you can afford.
Yeah.
Because there's no set number. Like, you could be put in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. You know, now you're in your 40s and you might not be able to work again. You can't buy enough insurance to compensate you, at least underinsured coverage, to protect you for that loss. It's crazy, but that's life, unfortunately.
Well, that's true. And if you're not paying attention and you cause an accident like that, unfortunately, you know, people can come after your assets if you have a minimum policy. So if you have a $15,000 policy, you have $1 million home, you know, they're going to come after you. So yeah, insurance is one thing that, you know, growing up, maybe my parents skimped on a little bit, right? But like, the you know, as an adult, I'm like, as an attorney, because I know these things now, you know, it's, I see how important it is, right? I remember Geico came out, right? Minimum coverage. Minimum price for minimum coverage or something.
Safe auto. It's one thing, you have to have insurance to get on the road, and that's why they actually enacted these limited tort laws back in the 90s or so. Pennsylvania was in the 90s, I think New Jersey was the late 90s, make it cheaper for people to get on the road, because we require insurance. That's the law, right? In every state you have to have auto insurance, but you're able to opt into a cheaper policy now with limited tort, but it actually ends up in the person anyway, because they have to have a serious injury and certain characteristics. I've had many clients throughout my career, they're in pain every day, but their injuries aren't, quote, serious enough under the legal definition that the judge determines, and they get the case thrown out of court, which is unfortunate for those people. Nagging injuries that may not have the magic thing show up on the MRI where the judge would throw it out of court. Luckily, in Pennsylvania, we don't see those motions. They call motions for summary judgment very often. I just had one filed against me last week. First time in like 8-10 years.
Get it up, the insurance company.
Good question. I think it's, might be Nation.
Okay. Sure.
But anyway, first time, and I think I'll win. But it's, we don't see them too often. I remember my first 2 years of practice in New Jersey, we had summary judgment motions for verbal threshold limited tort follow-ups all the time. Maybe it was just the kind of clients and the cases we had back then. Now I'm handling the most significant cases here in the firm, but I just don't see it too often in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so that's same with us in New York. When I first started in 2013 working for Josh, we would get them all the time. But now we get them less, and part of our business strategy is, that we don't have to deal with that as we're getting more quality cases.
Right. So what's your goal? To handle less cases but more serious cases?
Yeah, my goal is to make sure every client is taken care of and every client is happy, right? Whether your case is worth a dollar or whether your case is worth, you know, $10 million, I'm good. I know it's going to sound disingenuous, but I swear I will give it you and I will give it the full attention it deserves.
So if you accept a case, if Gropper and Najat accept a case, you're going to give it your all no matter what.
Absolutely.
So some firms accept every case. We call them mills, right? And they just work them up and see what happens. You know, John Cordisco and I made that determination in the beginning. We are going to focus on getting, that's a personal injury lawyer's dream, is to work on a few good cases. But it's hard to get to that place. But we always made it a rule to only accept as many cases as we can give that full attention to. And I think that's important because clients expect attention today. Customer service is number one. How do you see that at Gropper Law?
I think we have a lot of happy clients. Obviously, when people are going through things like this, they see you at your worst, right?
Yeah.
When people are going through things like this, you see them at their worst.
See them at their worst,
Because, you know, they're in the worst. They could possibly be at the worst part of their life they've ever experienced.
Especially if there's a death or something serious, yeah.
So a lot of times, you know, we just do our job and that makes the clients happy, right? But happy is relative. They're happy with the work we do, but, you know, even if you do get them a good recovery, their lives aren't going to be the same.
The process is not fun. I just met with a client yesterday, an older couple. She had two surgeries and she just had a brain surgery, and they think that a cyst that occurred may have been traumatically related. And the husband, he was a Vietnam vet, thank him for his service. He said, I like you. Like, I really like you, Mike. I like you, Jocelyn. But I don't like this process. I don't like what's happening here. And they have, I think, 300,000 and underinsured. We got them 100,000 already. We're working on that underinsured, but she just had recent brain surgery. And, you know, it's the process that's not fun. It's not, you know, you, and rightfully so, these clients believe they deserve the whole underinsured coverage.
Sure.
They've paid for that. I think it's with USAA. So he's a veteran, obviously, and he's paid since, I don't know what year, 70s and 80s, every single month paid into USAA. And now there's 300,000 available. Now, obviously, at this point, they're not offering it all yet. So I just told them, give it some time. We have to finish the treatment here, get some follow-ups so we can get our expert reports so that we can get that full 300,000 because they deserve. Yeah. They paid in for years for that money.
What I like to tell people is that this is the reason people need lawyers, because this is how they want you to feel, right? They want you to feel like it's just, you know, frustrated and to take anything. It's a strategy. That, yeah. That's what it is, because insurance is a big business.
They try to beat our clients down with time, effort. You know, even going into litigation is a big step for stressful. Their name's now on the court records in the county forever, filing a lawsuit. Half of my clients come to me and they're like, never thought I would file a lawsuit. I'm not that kind of person.
I'm not that kind of person.
Until what? The insurance company mistreats them.
Yep.
They try to take advantage of them. You know, I just recently heard through another attorney, because we're investigating a lot of AI programs I told you about at our firm. That's where the whole future of work is going, right? So this attorney told me the insurance companies are using AI so to determine which of their insureds who are in an accident are more likely to hire a lawyer. So they get to them faster with bigger offers to settle. When I say bigger offers, we're talking about 500 yeah. bucks, 700 bucks, when their claim could be worth hundreds of thousands. So they're targeting people through AI that have made a claim for injuries or been in an accident, and they're trying to get to them faster so that they could settle their claim with them before they get to a lawyer.
And let's be clear, the people that they're targeting are the most oppressed people. They're the people that likely need the recovery more than anybody else, or the more injured, the more desperate for the money. God forbid they need it for medical deductibles, things like that. But you know, if you come to a lawyer, right, it doesn't cost you anything, and you know, we'll take care of all that, and with the medical providers, as far as putting it on a lien, and getting it paid at the end of the loss.
So we just had every few years I get one of these calls where somebody signed a release before they got here.
Yeah,
they sent them a document. They think it's for wage loss. They think it's for their car. And it turns out to be a release of all claims. So do you have any advice for those people or the people that haven't signed a release that the insurance company is sending them something by email, DocuSign maybe to sign? What advice can you give someone who's just been in an accident that's getting a DocuSign or some kind of other thing to sign from an insurance company?
I'd say come see me, because we have had success with getting the, with you know, getting the release thrown out and being able to proceed with the lawsuit. So, you know, there's different circumstances, and it's not every time, but we have had success. And don't sign anything without letting an attorney see it. It's not going to cost you anything to come to my office and or even email to me and let me look at it, or we can talk about it, or email Mike. And don't sign anything. I mean, even like property damage, right?
Yeah.
There's three different parts of the accident. There's the part you sue for, bodily injuries, the property damage, which is the car accident, getting your car repaired, and then there's the medical, right? And so they'll send you a release for the property damage, but I always have my clients send it to me so I can change the language in there. Even on so
sometimes the checks say release of all claims,
yeah.
And they'll try to enforce that. It's really sneaky. I don't see it all the time, thank God, because I'd be really upset. But once in a while, they do it. So you're saying at Cropper and Asia, you'll offer a free consultation, right?
Always.
Free consultation. So if somebody has, you know, the insurance companies try to contact our clients before we get to them, or before they find us, right? And they're trying to get a statement out of them, right? Trying to pin them down to what they say, because they try to, it's like a criminal case, I always say, they try to use the statement against them. So whatever you say could be used against you. You heard that in criminal law before, right?
Yes.
So we always try to advise our clients, don't talk to any insurance company till you call us. we'll guide you on whether you should file a property damage claim or not with your insurance company or not. We'll take care of 99% of the communications with the insurance company so they stop calling. But all this is free, right? Unless there's a recovery. That's what a contingent fee agreement's, right? Right. You use that at Gropper Law? Contingent
yes.
fee?
Yes.
Well, so what does that mean?
It means that we don't get paid unless you get paid. I hate to say it like, you know, those old 90s commercials.
Yep.
But we work on a contingency fee basis. And that means essentially that we're the one-third partner, and you're the two-third partner of the lawsuit. So we're partners in it, yep. Right? And we want to settle as much as you do. And we're fronting all the litigation costs, but we also want to get our clients max value on every case.
So I always say that to clients, where it's almost like a partnership. We got to work together. We're going to provide the advice. You're going to follow the advice. And then eventually we're going to work together to get the maximum recovery as we can.
Yes.
Is that how you do it at Gropper?
That's exactly how we do it at Gropper Law. And I tell them, you worry about getting yourself better and going to treatment and go to your appointments, and we'll handle everything else.
Chris, as we wrap this conversation up today, what can a client expect when they call Najat and Gropper?
Well, first and foremost, that new name works for me.
I'm sorry. Hopefully Josh is not listening.
Yeah. Well, they can expect personal, a personal relationship, right? Like I said, we're partners in this. It kind of bonds you with the client. You guys are in it together, right? We're not one of those attorneys on TV. Have you been in a car accident? That's not what we do, right?
Yeah.
We're here to help, you know, and the situation can be frustrating. And I always tell my clients, call me. You know, if it's frustrating, call me. I can talk you through it. I can let you know what's happening. For example, clients, you know, depositions, you know, are very stressful for clients, right? And I tell them, hey, I do this every day, so it's not stressful for me. So if you had any issues with it, just call me, right? Communication. And that's what they can expect. They can expect me to be there for them.
The clients can expect to hear from you, talk to you. Get updates from your firm, right?
Yeah. You get me, you get Josh. We work on every case together. That's what you get.
And you handle cases from beginning all the way to trial, right?
Correct.
A lot of these law firms, they don't litigate cases in the personal injury world, but you guys handle a case from beginning to end, right?
Well, yeah. The insurance companies know us. They know we're willing to go to the mat. And, you know, that helps out, just like you guys. We're willing to go to the mat. In fact, early on, probably like 2014, 2015, we used to handle like the bigger trials for other attorneys in New York City who didn't go to the mat, right? Who weren't trial attorneys, but they did market as trial attorneys. And once we showed up to court and they saw that we were now handling the trial, the insurance companies and the attorneys would be like, all right,
yeah.
Well, you know, let's talk.
So taking those cases to trial, in my experience, gives you a good reputation that, you know, you don't mess around. Like if the insurance company doesn't offer money, you're going to take them to trial and try to get more. So I'm sure Gropper and Nasia in New
York, I like the first one,
enjoy that reputation, correct?
Yes, correct.
All right. Chris, thanks for joining us today. I think our viewers are going to get a lot out of this conversation. They learned a lot more about Gropper and Nasia. And where can we find Gropper and Najat? Can you tell these listeners where we can find them online and your phone number in case they want to call?
Sure, gropperandnajat.com. Our New York number is 212-366-4600, and our Jersey number is 856-420-2900, and we could also be emailed at info@gropperandnajat.com.
Thanks, Chris.
No problem, Mike. And Mike, again, office is absolutely incredible. Love it. If you haven't come to this office yet, get here. It's beautiful. And watching you grow your whole career and doing it the right way has absolutely been an inspiration to me. So thank you for being such a positive impact on my life.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for tuning in to The Injury Pros. Whether you're a practicing attorney or someone curious about what it takes to succeed in personal injury law, we appreciate you being here. Check out more episodes at injurypros.com and follow us wherever you get podcasts, or watch the full episodes on YouTube. Until next time.